Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucking ears, what the fucksters, what the fuckadelics, what's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. Thank you for tuning in. I appreciate it. How's it going? Hey, you know, if it's, I don't know what's going to happen. I'm recording this the day before. So Thursday, if there's still time, as there is, call your senators. Call your senators. Email them. Do whatever you need to do to voice your disapproval of rushing this heinous, murderous healthcare repeal bill through Congress, through the Senate. Do it. You don't want to see your neighbors die because they can't get health insurance or they lose the stuff they got. You just want to watch your neighbors and coworkers and friends or people that work for you or people you know just all of a sudden lose all hope because it's pulled out from under them. For what reason? For what reason? This is America. We should be the best, not the fucking most embarrassing shit show circus on the planet. If anybody's feeling extraordinarily excited and proud of what we're going through as a country right now, I don't know, man. I don't know what's up with you. I really don't. I know you probably don't like me, but man, where's your humanity? Where's your fucking class? Where's your dignity? Where's your national pride? What a fucking shit show. You just don't know what's going to happen from one day to the next, and you don't know when it's going to be all over because all of a sudden, it's not about the country anymore. It's just about protecting a narcissistic, spiteful lunatic who does not give shit number one about the United States of America. Zero shits he gives. All about himself. So you guys just keep being proud to protect him. Yeah. Yeah, that's good. That's what what's America all about? Oh, protecting a lunatic from himself. Great. Yeah. What a vision for the future. How's it going? Are you all right? We got a big show today. I'm not going to ramble on too much. I thought I'd just give a chipper little nudge to stay active. And anybody who thinks it's not that it's a liberal or conservative issue, healthcare, you're out of your mind. You think this is some sort of wrestling show that ends in the apocalypse. Yeah. The world's greatest heel. The last great heel. Yeah. I can't. Right there. You felt that pause? Fell right down the ditch. Right down the rabbit hole of horrendous darkness. It's always right there. It's like hovering beside you now. What's that next to you? Oh, that is I thought that was an invisible tunnel to hell. No, it's not. We're all going through it. All of us, the entire world being sucked through a selfish tunnel to hell. Hey, but if you're proud and excited, Godspeed. If you're terrified and angry, speak up, make those phone calls, hit those streets. God damn. All right. On a lighter note, I got an email here. Subject line, you just got better without trying. Mark, a few days ago, I had a 3-hour drive up north to run the San Francisco Marathon. I had a few unlistened to episodes of WTF on deck, but I wanted to save those for the marathon and decided to try another top-rated podcast through iTunes. It sucked. Tried another. It was boring. Tried a third. The guy was being overly dramatic for the subject matter. I've listened to most of your 800-plus episodes while running, and they helped the miles slip past. I've been growing concerned that you might hang it up soon because you're sounding a bit over it. If you stop, I may quit running and get fat. That's on your shoulders. Thanks for all of your effort, Soren. I'm not over the podcast. I'm a bit over almost everything, pal. I'm just trying to get by like the rest of yous. But no, yeah, I'm not going to let you get fat, pal. And I wish I could apply that to me listening to podcast thing to me getting out and running. I'm exercising, I'm not running enough. But what, you know what? Who cares? Big show today. Can't ramble on too long. Got two guests. Got a shorty and a longie. Got Joe Mandy coming up, who I love. Joe Mandy, the very funny comedian. And then David Alan Greer, one of the funniest people alive, coming up. Joe Mandy has been on this show before, and he's a very funny guy, a very bright guy. I was happy that he came over. I like talking to Joe. He has a new stand-up special called Joe Mandy's award-winning stand-up special that is now streaming on Netflix. And he stopped by here. He stopped by the garage to chat a little bit. This is me and the sharp and funny Joe Mandy.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
Andy. It's no place good, Joe.
I don't think so. I mean, I'm doing great. That's what I'm dealing with right now.
Me
it's
too.
Like, it's a hellscape everywhere, but like my immediate surroundings.
Yeah, very. But you know, a little. It's probably a little. The perimeter is probably bigger than just immediate surroundings, yeah. But if you are engaged and you are paying attention, you feel a little shitty about having feeling okay about yourself.
Yeah.
But I always had that in my head, though. Like I've talked about that a bit on stage, where there's always been part of me, no matter how good things are, mm-hmm. which they haven't been this good for me personally ever.
Uh-huh.
But there's always part of me that wants to be like, nah, but it's still kind of fucked.
Right.
But now it's like it is. You know, it's not, I'm not making it up.
No.
It's kind of fucked.
No, it's super fucked.
Yeah.
It's like cartoonish.
Scary.
How evil.
Yeah.
Things are. It's like this is hack. Like if someone pitched some of this stuff, I'd be like, this is too much.
But what have you been up to? You coming over on a Saturday, I assume you're writing somewhere.
Yeah, I'm writing on a show called The Good Place right now on NBC.
Oh, wait. Who's in that?
That's Kristen Bell and Ted Danson are the two stars. Yeah. Ted Danson is a part of my daily life, which is cool. It's the coolest.
But, is he a good guy?
He really is.
Yeah?
Yeah, it was a relief. That's the type of person you just hope when...
You don't know, right?
Yeah, you really don't. But he's like... He's a person, his like reputation precedes him.
And right.
Like, you just like, okay, well, we'll see. And then it's all true. He's the coolest.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
It's so bizarrely disappointing to identify with or know somebody your whole life on television.
Yeah.
And then they're just fucking monsters.
I know. It's a very like particular sadness that's hard, you know, because you don't want to like tell people about it. You want people to just like continue believing that.
Well, that's the weird thing that you learn in show business is that, you know, some people are, you know, it's a degree. It's a sad thing about how connected everybody is, because there is an element of like, you know, respecting somebody's work and then realizing they're an asshole. Mm-hmm. But, you know, party is like, no, I got to tell everybody.
I definitely have no trouble telling. Yeah.
But now it's sort of like, oh, fuck.
Yeah.
You got to fight the urge to tell the world.
It's mostly like, it's like when you go home and you're hanging out with people from high school.
Right, right,
or whatever.
Right. And they're like, what's going on? So you know so-and-so?
Yeah, then you're like, yeah, he's cool.
Yeah, yeah. Right.
You know, because it's like, what's the point of...
I have to be careful with it, because I've been pretty diplomatic the last few years.
Mm-hmm.
But now that like I feel okay about myself, that's when I start throwing people under the
right,
bus.
Right, right, right.
But not in a bad way, not my friends necessarily, but like you learn in show business, it's sort of like just, you know, be nice and you know, say like, yeah, that guy's pretty good.
I wish I had that in me. I have a couple friends who, you know, can go Like, they'll be at a party where everyone is talking shit, and then you, like, go home, and you're like, oh, that person didn't say a single thing. They laughed and nodded, but made nothing.
Nothing. Yeah. And then you're like, how do I trust that guy?
I know. Yeah. I got to start talking shit about that
guy. Yeah, what's up with that dude? What's he going to say about, ugh. What is it? Is this new special? Because I know you wanted me to do something for it, and I didn't. And I'm sorry.
No, it's fine. No, no, it was...
What was the angle? What makes it different? Because I know there was it's not just a straight stand-up special.
It is. I mean, it's an hour stand-up. It's sort of bookended with this sketch stuff that I wrote. Sort of the premise of the sketch stuff is that I'm trying to perform like the perfect special.
Yeah.
So I'm getting the first part is like I'm getting advice from. You know.
Okay. So some from peers and from heroes.
Yes,
and whatnot.
Exactly. And then it's the special, and it's all building up to this award show called the American Humor Awards. And then when the special ends, then we actually shot the fake award show. And
it's a fake award show?
Yeah, it's not a real thing. I mean, it's super. We made it look like the Oscars mixed with like the Mark Twain Prize. Yeah, it's really stupid. Yeah, but I reached out to a couple people. It was, you know, and it was like the first time I've ever felt like a producer doing anything, because I was just like desperately trying to like.
Who'd you get?
For that particular bit, it was George Wallace and Bo Burnham are the two people giving me advice.
But that's outside the box. That's good.
Yeah, and then George was, man, they're both so funny in it.
Yeah.
It was like...
George is something.
Yeah, he really is.
Was he wearing his beret?
Of course he was, yeah.
He didn't always wear it. I don't know when that started happening. I remember him pre-beret.
The main bit in the special
is
that... I'm performing my special for the Council of Judges award show.
Okay.
So like there are a few cutaways to these like very like prestigious looking judges.
Right.
Yeah. So like they're like taking notes, but that's
interesting. Yeah. So you created a narrative outside of the stand up.
Right, but it's not, I hope, you know, from my perspective, I didn't think it like was distracting.
Well, you're a great stand-up and you're a great joke writer, and it's like one of those things where when I see you on Conan or something, I'm like, this guy's so good. But you know, you definitely have, you're a writer.
Yeah.
And how's that struggle going?
I mean, now it's just sort of bipolar. Like I spend like 6 months or so writing on whatever, and then we'll just spend the rest of the year like touring and.
Now, did you get married?
I did, yeah.
How long ago was that?
A couple years ago.
Really?
Yeah.
I haven't talked to you that long in any way?
Yeah.
How's the marriage?
Good, yeah.
Do you have a kid?
No kid. I mean, we have two dogs we treat like children.
Sure.
Yeah.
And what does she do? Is she in show business?
She is not. She works for the ASPCA.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Does she do like hands-on stuff? Like?
Sometimes. She's mostly does like marketing and...
For ASPCA?
Yeah, and like copywriting.
What do they do exactly?
I mean, they have shelters in New York.
Yeah.
But they also have they fund these task forces that break up like dog fighting rings and cock fighting rings. And,
oh, really?
Those stories where you hear about like hoarders who have like 12 cats, or horses that are just, you know, skeletons.
The ones where they find the cats in the garbage.
Yeah, I mean,
Just like the bones.
Right. And yeah, the pancakes.
Lady, yeah, and the lady's like, I wondered what happened.
I mean, that's sort of like, it's mostly like when it's like usually bigger cases where like they have to bring in like they essentially have like a SWAT team on call to like
for like people with 50 cats.
Yeah, it's nuts. Yeah.
Oh my god.
She's also like she gets these phone calls that are like confidential and then she can't tell me, but she'll be like
top secret animal,
something that... is about to happen.
Does it break in the news?
Yeah, sometimes. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's crazy.
There's some shit going down.
There was a crazy thing last year where she had to go to North Carolina for a week because there were so many animals at this place that they raided that they had to like essentially rent out a airport hangar and just like there was like hundreds of animals.
Of all different kinds?
Yeah, until they could like figure out where to put them all. Just like,
oh my God.
All hands on deck, people flying in from all over the country to like...
ASPCA forces.
Yeah, yeah. She was like cleaning out cat cages.
Got a suburban zoo issue.
Yeah, basically, yeah. It's crazy.
There's a place in North Carolina where they have tigers, the tiger rescue.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It's pretty wild.
It's crazy. I went to we went to a ostrich farm in Solvang recently.
In Solvang?
Yeah.
Wow, just a visit?
We were there for a wedding, but then, you know, we had a day to kill in Solvang.
It's like seeing dinosaurs.
It really is. It's like the lamest Jurassic Park, but they are freaky and they just eat food out of your hands.
They're giant birds.
They're giant birds and they run in a very funny fashion.
They're real dinosaurs.
They are, yeah.
It's wild. What are they farm them up there?
The meat? Don't really know. I mean, it like,
what else are you going to use it for? What would you have an ostrich farm for? People eat ostrich meat.
Yeah, they were selling ostrich jerky, but they also had like ostrich eggs signed by Khloe Kardashian that was like in a glass case. So maybe
that's important.
That is, yeah.
Well, what's going on with the Twitter feed? What were you doing? You were retweeting. You made a career out of retweeting things.
Yeah.
What was that? What was the angle on that again?
Just
corporate retweets.
I did that for a while.
What was it though? Them doing.
I used to have fun on like 9/11, like 9/11 corporate tweets was fun.
Yeah.
Gun manufacturers often tweet funny stuff on holidays. Now I'm just like, I'm so deep into like Trump.
Yeah.
Like idiot universe that I feel filthy. Like I have.
I've pulled out totally.
Oh, I'm fully in.
I can't. Do you fight with Nazis?
Oh yeah. 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 It's like, it's very strange to just become completely desensitized to like seeing your face being shoved into an oven by a cartoon frog or whatever. So like, yeah. Okay.
You are desensitized?
Totally. 1,000. It does nothing. Yeah.
Was there a point where it did?
I mean, it's Dave Chappelle's monologue when he hosted SNL.
Yeah.
It's just like, we have a internet troll as president. Like, that's what it is. And so, like, it's just trolling. Like, I don't, like, it doesn't really affect me. If it were something else, maybe it would affect me, but I'm sort of desensitized to
that. Do you find that, well, let me ask you this, because what happened with me in Twitter was that, you know, once he took office, I was like, I'm done. I'm done feeding this. I don't want to fight. It is taxing to me.
Yeah.
I'm not desensitized.
Yeah.
It's not so much I take it personally, but it's sort of like it takes up energy. It causes me aggravation because even if I'm being desensitized towards, you know, horror is one thing, but engaging in emotional fighting, like the idea that you're going to win.
No, yeah. I mean, like, when you say, like, am I fighting with Nazis? Not really. Like, I don't really respond to people that often. Yeah,
right.
Like, it's mostly, like,
you'll tweet something out and you'll see it come
make
down.
Fun of something like Donald Trump Jr. says or whatever.
Yeah, right.
Seb Gorka or any of those people.
Yeah. Yeah. I haven't heard his name in a while. But, yeah, I was like, I'm not feeding this anymore.
I feel you. I mean, like, I
feel better, dude. I have more time.
That's great.
Like, it's not, you know, I'm not great sitting with myself, but it's a nice to know that's still operative.
I know. I mean, it's super unhealthy. It really is. And I'm like, I just vacillate between like just the darkest part of like Trump Twitter. And then like to get relief, I will then just read like NBA trade rumors. And that's like what makes me happy. It's like one of the few things in the world. So it's just like, it's either basketball that makes me happy or just like, I'm just like going back and forth.
But in the big picture, do you feel as an intelligent person who fights a good fight, do you feel that Twitter is doing anything good?
No, I mean, well, the thing is, and not that it's like a noble fight because it's not, it's stupid, but there is something to the fact that like this is the medium that the president has chosen to be his like
his lifeline to his people.
Right. So
you got to be dragged down to his level. That's a unique thing. It's like we're all being dragged down to the president's level.
It's crazy.
Level.
Yeah. But I, you know, there are, I actually just recently, I paid some website like $12 to just delete all my old tweets from like anything older than like 2 years ago or something.
Yeah. And they do that?
Yeah. I don't know how, but it's just like, I was just like, I don't need a like permanent, I don't
history.
Need like some, like whatever I was yelling at 10 years or 2010 to like haunt me later.
Right.
So yeah, just.
Well, I think that it's interesting because sometimes I'll look at Twitter. I don't like, and occasionally I'll answer questions, but I primarily use it for promo now. Yeah. And like I'll answer questions sometimes if I'm, but I used to be locked into it. Like, you know, you'd spend hours there, you know, and now I do think that it does good because sometimes I learn things first there. Like, because I'm not tapped into every news site.
Right.
And sometimes someone will tweet something like, oh, fuck.
Right.
That happened.
Yeah.
And also I think that, you know, organizing, I think sometimes it's proactive and it helps. And it seems to me that the hashtag President Bannon actually got up Trump's ass.
Seemed like it more the magazine cover.
Oh, that was it. Yeah,
I think
yeah.
That's how you get in.
That's how you something that gets ratings.
Yeah, it's like it's literally like whoever's on the cover of Time magazine.
That'll do it.
Yeah, it's crazy. He's a fucking child.
Yeah. Yeah. There's some big problems, dude. Yeah. Yeah, like, I really don't know. You know, it's never a dull moment.
I've never felt this like embarrassed before.
I know,
Bush was president, I didn't feel like I could travel abroad and, you know, not feel like embarrassed.
With Bush, you were sort of like, I didn't do that.
I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. Right. But this guy, it's sort of like, oh my God.
Yeah. My favorite thing is to talk to people about, like, yeah, you hate Trump. Everyone hates Trump in my world.
Yeah.
But it's like, I love finding out who's like the second person, you know? Because some days for me is Jared Kushner. Like, I obsess over Jared Kushner. He makes me crazy.
Uh-huh.
And then sometimes it's, you know, Jeff Sessions or whoever. But it's like,
Bannon's
yours. Yeah. Yeah. You're a Bannon guy.
I'm a Bannon guy. You know, and like, you know, I was a Bannon Stephen Miller guy, but mm-hmm. I don't know. Stephen Miller seems to have, you know, found his way, you know, up Jared's ass somehow.
Sure.
This weird alignment between, you know, white supremacists and grandchildren of Holocaust survivors.
Orthodox Jews.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's
unbelievable.
I don't know what's happening at that level. But, all right, so when's the special on?
July 25th.
Okay.
Yeah.
And your dogs are good?
Dogs are great.
Wife is good?
Yeah.
You're happy with the special?
I think so.
Well, do you get that weird thing where you like, you know, like, but I'm a stand-up, not a writer?
Yes. I mean, I think it's pretty clear that I'm working through those issues in the special itself. Just
good.
Like the way, yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's like, totally.
I mean, the money's good with writing. You're in a good environment. Mm-hmm. You like the show you're on. You go pitch jokes. But in your heart, you're a stand-up.
Yes. And then there are times where, like, I'll be on the road for 3 weeks.
Yeah.
And I'm alone ordering like Domino's pizza and some awful
by
place.
Yourself.
It's just like, I should be at my job. What am I doing?
Is this the quality of life I'm looking forward to?
Right. I don't know. So, I mean, I'm still trying to figure out like the right balance. I definitely feel like I'm sort of half of both or whatever.
Well, yeah, but you know, in your heart and your mind that like, no matter how bad it's going to get over there at the office, I got WGA health insurance, you know, I got a pretty steady paycheck as long as the show's on the air.
Right.
That shit makes a difference.
Yeah, it does. Totally.
Yeah. All right. Well, it's good talking to you, Joe.
Good talking to you.
All right. As I mentioned, Joe Mandy. That was Joe Mandy. His new stand-up special called Joe Mandy's Award-Winning Stand-Up Special is now streaming on Netflix. Go enjoy that. David Alan Greer. Wow, dag. He's been around for a long time, and he's always been fucking funny. Always been funny. From Living Color to the movies, to being on Broadway, to being on the radio, to the Carmichael Show. He's been around a long time, too, man. And we don't really know each other. I think we met once, but I was excited to talk to him. He has a new show on GSN called Snap Decisions. It premieres Monday, August 7th. The series finale of The Carmichael Show airs August 9th on NBC. I do want to make clear that when I talked to him, I did not know that the show had been canceled. And he told me after. I don't know. But I was sad to hear that. I liked it. But we talked about everything. There's a lot of stuff. You know, he had quite a life and he was, he wanted to be an actor, and he's a great actor, but he's also one of the funniest guys around. This is me and David Alan Greer talking here in the garage. You know, if Trump wanted to play by the same rules as Obama...
Well, what are the rules?
We get final cut. They don't get to vet questions.
All right,
they, you know, like, I mean, he's pretty good like that. I'm not sure what I would do with him or what point it would serve, because
I just think you'd have to just turn the thing on and just.
I know, but what are you going to get? You know what?
Trump, just him.
I know, but he gives that all the time, and it's all bullshit. True. And you know, it's like, you know, what if that's if I can get to the core of it? I mean, I grew up with a narcissistic dad. I know what's in there. I know it's at the core of that personality.
Yeah, my
a whole
dad,
lot of
my
fuck
dad
you.
Was a psychiatrist.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So, so what do you make of it? What do you make of your dad being a psychiatrist?
Well, he just passed. Well, he didn't just pass. He passed away about a year ago. And what do I make of it? Most of my he never got psychiatric on me. You know, because that's that
like, that you
that's
know the, of.
Well, yeah, okay, but except for one time.
Uh-huh.
But it's not because I think the perception is the routine comeback is your father's a psychiatrist.
Yeah.
Well, did he analyze you? No, that day to day was not. I think you're, let's use our words.
Oh, right,
you know,
right.
No, he was just like, sit down, shut up, you know, like a normal parent. Except for one time when I was like, you know, feeling myself. I said, Dad, what's the. What's the definition of insanity? And he just looked at me and smirked. He goes, it means nothing. It is a legal definition. Like, you idiot.
Right.
Shut up.
Yeah, what are you talking
Get
about?
Get out of the car. I'll pick you up at 5. And I was like, oh, words are weapons.
I think that the generally, it seems to me that the common thing about being the kid of a psychiatrist is that they're always a little weird.
Well, yeah.
I married the child of a psychiatrist.
Well, then
and but she didn't strike me as weird. But then I knew some other kids, and they seemed weird. But I don't know why that would be. Maybe that's something we project onto people. Your dad's a shrink.
It was
weird.
Always projected on me. You know,
it was.
Yeah, yeah. But you know, he passed away.
My
father died, and we just got these papers, all this stuff of this writing that he did. A long time ago about his life. It was kind of like, I don't know what it was.
Unpublished?
No, yeah, yeah, absolutely. They were just private, you know, musings. Like, he had had a series of questions. Clearly, this is an elongated biography. My father also was an author. So I don't know at what time whatever. But he would always use any kind of method to write.
Yeah.
But the point being is, as an African-American, going to med school and desiring to become a psychiatrist at that time, I think there were one or two other black students in med school at Michigan. And so that's what was incredible. And, you know, studying at the Menninger Clinic and this and that.
It was at the Menninger Clinic. That's a big one.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And it was.
So it's a completely unique experience he's writing about. To be one of two or three African Americans.
Yes, absolutely.
So that must have been what. So it talks about his challenges, maybe.
He talks about
right.
But more it was you know, by rote. But there was some insight, meaning as a young student, you know, or as a resident, faced with probably 99.9% Caucasian men,
right.
Just how do you get ahead? And I know my father told me, he said, well, I really didn't have a choice. If you wanted to be your own boss and you were a person of color, you had to be a doctor, lawyer, dentist, or else you're working for someone who's white who will subjugate you.
Or a shop owner of some kind.
Yes, exactly.
Right,
so
right.
You had to go into business for yourself. And so that was the whole aim. So
it wasn't necessarily a passion to you think that it was, well, it must have been.
No, my father was
psychiatry. That's not like when you're thinking about, I want to go into business.
I didn't go into it. I wasn't smart enough.
That seems like a lot to put in. You know, you got to put in the medical school, the internship, the residency.
In 1940 something.
That's crazy.
So yeah. Like what were you thinking? And so my dad is and was the smartest person I ever knew. I mean, I think he went to college and he was like 16 and, you know, he's brilliant.
He's really
smart.
So how much of this writing is there?
Well, I found two copies. My brother and I think my father's
just
widow.
Two of you?
Yeah. No, my sister.
Uh-huh.
I'm the youngest.
Yeah.
But we found these papers. They were given to us, you know, from his widow who's cleaning out stuff. You guys might want to.
Yeah.
But two different copies of the same thing. Most of it is family history. You know, my grandmother was born in 1900. And I remember, you know, a ritual when I was with my grandmother, when I was very little, we'd sleep, you know, do sleepover. And I see grandmother tell me about when you were a little girl.
Uh-huh.
And she would always start with these sweet stories. And it was like, and then that boy was lynched and they cut his tongue out and hung him by his penis. Anyway, who wants a cookie? You know, I'm like, ooh. But, you know, as a kid, I just was fascinated. It was like hearing about the Wild West.
Yeah, absolutely. You know?
So as I got older, then I realized this is not just an adventure. This is
reality.
Exactly.
Yeah,
and it's
yeah.
racist and hate-filled. You know, as a child, it's just the adventure. Like when the stagecoach was, you know, raided by the Indians. That's what it sounded like.
Well, you can't connect it to reality until you put things into context. It's just a horrible story.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
so
yeah.
It sounds like your dad intended to publish this thing if there were two copies of it.
It ain't getting published now. Don't even, I know you're already. So this is a painting that you found on the back of a masterpiece. No, but it does, you know, I have a daughter.
Why can't you publish it? You could publish it. Does he have a following? What was, he wrote a book.
He was 89. Yeah, he had a big following in 68.
Yeah, you know? 1968.
Oh, yeah. But my father was the radical, he and my mom, they got a divorce. He left.
Yeah.
He moved out to San Francisco.
Right.
The summer before the Summer of Love.
Right.
So he was on the cusp of hypnosis.
So that was just the summer of racial bullshit.
Yes. Well,
before the Summer of Love, it was just like 10 years of horrible racial tension.
Well, we had driven out. I remember one summer vacation. My brother just reminded me of this. Like, we were kids in Detroit. We went to Disneyland. I was like 9 years old. We drove across country. And every stop, you know, once we got to Amarillo, Texas, that was the first stop. You know, my father would come back to the car.
Guys, they don't like Negroes. So let's keep our voice. Boys, stay in the car, please.
Yeah.
Jeffrey, put your skateboard down. Let's just listen with our ears.
So there was a lot of that. But as kids, I remember my brother and I, we'd go to these motels. There would be these white kids in the pool. We'd jump in the pool. They ran out.
No.
And I'm like, let's go chase them. My brother was like, man, get your motherfucking ass in the car. They hate you, you big head. You know, and you'd punch me. But to me, it was like, no, man, let's go make them play with us.
You still didn't get it.
No. To this day, I do not. I'm telling you the truth.
Right.
Danny McBride, I'm at the airport early in the morning. I see him, you know, and I just go over there and introduce myself. We're on the same flight.
Yeah.
Whatever. 2 days later, I get an offer to do this film. And I type to my email on my agent. I'm like, that is so crazy because, you know, Danny and I were on the same flight. And I introduce myself and I get this offer. The universe is bananas. And there was just silence. And then it's like, yeah, he said that he met you. Then he gave you the offer. I said, but what's the connection, though? There is none. It's just providence. You know, I still didn't get it. I still didn't. Yes, idiot. So that's why you got the offer.
That's great. You live in a magical world. You're lucky.
Dense.
Yeah, everything is magic to you.
But then there was like, maybe I shouldn't verbalize. I should just internalize so they don't realize what kind of way.
But I'm
kind of
interested in the idea. So your dad moves to San Francisco?
Oh, yeah. Okay. So I'm going to bounce around a lot.
In 1968?
Well, no. Here's what it went down. You know, my parents, I remember there was a family meeting. And my mom and dad's like, you know, your father and I are having problems. And we want you to know. This was very psychiatric when I think back. We want you kids to
progressive.
Know. It's not your fault.
Right.
It is our issue that we're going to work through.
Right.
And we're not getting a divorce. And it was like, that's the word. Like, what is a divorce? These are the words I learned as a child. What is assassination? How is assassination different than murder? Then I was told, you know, when Kennedy and all that. So divorce, what is divorce? You know, and they told us, and then we told all our friends we're supposed to move to California. We packed up.
Yeah.
My father goes ahead, and that was it. You know, he writes to my mom a letter, by the way, you're not joining us. So that's how it went down.
Yeah.
Very classic 60s
divorce. Yeah.
And so he got a waterbed, a dashiki,
mm-hmm.
you know. He was, come on. Uh-huh. He was like a midlife crisis. It's the 60s.
Some African art and posters?
Not African art.
No.
But he did like, you know, the peripheral Black Panther stuff, you know.
Sure. Do you have one of these Afro rakes?
Oh, yes. I remember my father taking us to the barbershop.
Yeah.
Cut these boys' hair in an afro. You are not colored, you black. You know, I was like, oh, okay.
He made the jump.
Oh, yeah. Shit. So when Obama was like elected, my father was like,
fuck him. He's not black enough. He should be telling all these white folks, kiss my ass.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and that would have helped out.
Exactly. Like, yeah, Dad, he could do that, but he's probably not going to be president. You know, he didn't want to hear it.
But so did you, so you went back and forth from Detroit to San Francisco when, as a kid? Or like?
Well, we went to visit my dad. We would see him like,
so you live
once
with your mom.
A year. Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, it was absolutely. But I remember going to visit him. So you got to imagine this. It was 68
That's
in
crazy.
San Francisco.
A circus.
Oh, my God. We get off the plane, and my father goes, I'm going to take you to People's Park. And we're like, you know, you got to hear this. This is our political education. We're like, what kind of park is this?
Yeah.
You know, there's a fence around it, and there are no toys.
where are the swings?
Yeah, you know, my father's like, the toys are in your mind.
Yeah, man.
Your money Then he takes us to the Black Panther headquarters, and we see the hippies, and we're just like.
You went? He took you to Oakland?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
That was a tourist spot.
And for your dad.
Here's
the Panthers.
Yeah, we got there the day that Bobby Hutton, who was a 16-year-old Black Panther, was murdered by the police.
Okay.
It was his funeral. So, and we were like, now you're taking us to a funeral? What the fuck is this? You know, where is Disneyland?
Yeah.
So that was my life, you know. And then going back to Detroit, you know, my dad had this huge book.
What book was it?
It was called Black Rage.
Was that his term? Did he coin that term?
You have to Google it. Before I say yes, I don't want to, you know, put my foot in it, but it became, whatever it was, it became popularized by this book. This book was a huge bestseller.
What was it about?
It was the Black Rage defense, meaning you, Mark, and your forefathers have subjugated and oppressed me so much that if I stab the fuck out of you right now, that's because of my inherent built-in Black Rage.
Well, you had family in Eastern Europe?
Don't, man. I see what you're trying to do. No, but I mean, that's part of it. But,
my people were helping you.
Exactly. No, I have a Jewish friend. She goes, so what? My great grandmother was raped by the Cossacks. We all have a cross.
We tried to make up for it. We were down there. We got you the voting thing. We were down there.
No, but I mean, so I'm. You have to read it.
Yeah.
Because one of the things my
did
father
you read
did.
It?
Of course.
No.
One of the things my father did for the rest of his life is like, you know, he hated when that book was used as a legal defense.
Yeah.
He hated like professional psychiatrists, you know, DeAndre severed Mark's head because he felt oppressed by his white presence. You know, he didn't like all that stuff, you know. So
he saw it more as an academic thing as opposed to a practical defense for any crime a black person might commit.
That's one aspect, but he also didn't like people moving when he talked, so but you put them all together. Literally.
Was he a clinical psychiatrist?
Yes.
So he had an office, people would come over?
Yes. But he had an office, and it was very 60s, because I remember going down to visit him. So it had
in Detroit?
Yes.
Yeah.
There was a downtown plaza that was very hip. It's called Lafayette Park.
Yeah.
And when he moved there, he had another office in downtown Detroit, like the book building, which was just, you know, regular downtown. But he moved to this new office. It had the double door, the couch. It looked like a fucking James Bond movie. And, you know, the white chick was the secretary. Oh, hello, David. I was like, yeah, man, this is it.
This is how you live.
Hell yeah.
So
drove a Buick 225.
Is that Detroit that you grew up in, is it gone? I mean, like, what part of, like, I hear things I don't want to judge. I know that there's some areas of Detroit that are coming back. I've performed outside of Detroit, but the news out now is that, you know, Detroit's sort of decimated.
All right, listen, I'm talking pre-riot, early 60s Detroit. You know, in our minds,
industrial powerhouse.
Like, yeah, man, it was like the cars.
The city.
It was before the Japanese or Europeans. We were king of the world.
Glorious city.
Fuck yeah. It was like the fifth largest city in the world.
Yeah.
In America, rather.
Yeah.
And we thought, I live in a cosmopolitan area. You went to private schools and very hip and cool. And this is the life, you know.
So you went to a private school?
For a while. Like when we were very young, I just got these pictures from like kindergarten, first to second grade. And it's me and a sea of racists. No, and a sea of like white kids, you know. And there's like the one
wearing
other.
A little jacket? Were you wearing a little jacket?
Oh, suit and tie.
Oh, really?
And I had this bolo like. Uh-huh. It was really little kid stuff.
So that's an interesting kind of upbringing in terms of like, you know, because I, people make assumptions that there was a very healthy black middle class in Detroit when you were growing up.
Yeah.
That's it.
Well, think about this. You know, the car companies, when they were thriving,
yeah,
that was a very comfortable middle class existence that people could count on.
Right.
From high school until retirement.
Yeah.
So that was guaranteed. These were post-war union jobs.
Yeah.
African-Americans. I mean, that's why all of these black people were in Chicago, Detroit. I mean, that's what attracted them initially.
Yeah.
Is these jobs. I think my grandmother's brothers, so my grand uncles, you know, one comes, then the whole family comes. They have
where
jobs
are they from?
Here. They're originally from Mississippi by way of Alabama. Uh-huh. So forget about it. If you're saying in the 30s.
Yeah. Let's get the fuck out.
Oh, hell yeah. This is an actual life where we won't be oppressed and beaten and killed and lynched. So that's the scenario. And very progressive. I mean, we went to, as a kid, you know, my father's friends, we all went to this, quote, progressive, really progressive school at that time. So that was the first kind of school I remember, the school bus and all that stuff.
Oh, yeah? Like what progressive, not like a Montessori school, but just an integrated, tolerant, kind of like this is the way democracy works.
Oh, absolutely. I remember being brought into the auditorium and watching the assassination coverage of John F. Kennedy. You know, I think I was in first or second grade, a 19-inch black and white television.
You do remember that.
Oh, absolutely. Oh. I remember our class, we wrote sympathy letters to Jackie Kennedy.
Yeah, yeah.
Of course, they were graded.
Come on.
I'm not kidding you. For
so
years,
they sent them out with a B minus on them?
When David said, I'm sorry, that's a compound word. There was no compound. Yeah. And it was marked up, but I lost the letter. I wish I could find it because it was.
So that's like, because you're a little older than me. Like, I'm 53.
I'm 47.
No, I'm sorry. I must have misread. 47. Died. You look great.
Well, thank you. I just dyed my mustache. Yes, I'm 61.
Mm-hmm. So you do have memory. Like, I was born the year that he got shot, 2 months before he was shot. I don't have any memory. Yeah. I have memories of Watergate, and Vietnam War, looking at the
Watergate
TV.
Watergate was boring to me after, like, everyone
just guys
shot.
Sitting at microphones. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, for hours. Right. But the Vietnam War, I remember that on TV. Like, it was terrifying. I just remember guys in the jungle. Mm-hmm. You know, like, it's just bad news.
First of all, I there was a kid, one of my best friends around the block.
Yeah.
His teenage cousin, went to Vietnam. So I'd never heard a word like Vietnam. It was like Klingon to me. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I was like, what is a Vietnam? Where is it? And he said, you know, it's in Asia.
Yeah.
And his cousin fought in spider holes. And immediately, I'm like, they have spider holes big enough for people to crawl into in a place called Vietnam? I don't want to be there.
Is that what they're fighting?
So that was my introduction to it. But I remember watching.
You've progressed to that one, haven't you?
Not much. Fake news. I'm all for it. Come on. Isn't that what we do every night?
You live in magic land.
Yes, of course. There's no connection. Yeah. Mark, come on. But I remember watching the draft.
Yeah.
Lottery.
Right.
And my brother's number was 18, I think. Like, he should have been on the first bus. And he got out of it.
He's that much older than you?
He's 4 years older than me. So, and it was like the end of the war, like 70, 71.
Yeah, yeah, right. That was bad then, because then they're just shoveling people to die.
Yes.
There was, you know, like, if you got there that year, it's sort of like, this is just about me. Yes. If you want me to go someplace I don't want to go, I'm going to shoot you.
Oh, yeah. Well, so... You know, I'm talking about this because for years I thought my dad was so brilliant. He got my brother off. And it wasn't until I was grown, my dad goes, he had nothing to do with it. You know, my brother, like, you know, didn't bathe for like 2 weeks, you know, and just took a bunch of speed and walked in there talking crazy. And they're like, you, sir, may remain home.
We're not going.
Exactly. We don't need you. We
And we don't know what you're talking about.
Exactly.
It seems like you understand it.
There's no connection, sir.
So where did you go to, like, how did it progress for you? So when you were a kid, you grew up in a nice life, you know, well-educated, good folks.
Beautiful house, same
house. What'd your mom do?
She was just, well, I don't want to say just, she was, as a young child, until my father left, you know, she was a housewife.
Right.
And then once the divorce, you know, he left, and then she went back to teaching, which she always hated, which there's a perverse comedy in there now, but she was just the, she hated it, but she had to do it.
She was like a kindergarten teacher,
and you know, so.
And she went back to that hating kids, hating teaching them.
Well, I feel bad, but I mean, we were like, you know, when you're kids, you're like, dude, come on, man, I need Hot Wheels, let's go.
Yeah.
You don't want to hear about, you know, fulfillment. No, you're just like, I am. What's more important than me?
Well, what was your like? What were you aspiring to as a kid? Like when you did? Well, you're in a magic bubble. We've established that.
What compelled you towards the arts? You know what I used to do? When I was a little kid, at the back of Boy's Life, or, you know.
Oh, my God. I haven't heard about that magazine in a while.
Or, like, they had the
Boy's Life.
Yeah. Can you draw this fawn?
Sure.
And I would do that. They'd be like, sir, you have, you're brilliant.
Those animals with the human eyes issue, like the sort of like compassionate eyes. There was a squirrel or something. A fawn. So you drew it. Sent it in.
And that was before I found out that it was kind of a ripoff. But I mean, I just remember like I wanted to be a painter.
Yeah.
An artist or biology, you know.
Painter or biology,
yeah,
sure.
Animals. I memorized every amphibian.
Oh, yeah.
And toad and frog.
You still remember them?
Yeah, I know it's not in Michigan because they used to put out these regional things. I know that we don't have bullfrogs. We have green frogs.
Oh, good, good.
Which was a little sadness.
Sure, but in the event that someone goes, look at that bullfrog, you're like, green nope, green uh-uh. Yeah, and then you have an argument, maybe get hit.
I would argue you down.
Sure, sure.
Because for, what was it, show and tell?
Uh-huh.
I would get up there with this book and just lecture the class on why we don't have Pacific spotted lake turtles in Michigan because
so you like the research of it. Right? Like I saw some map of rats yesterday. you get the Norway rat.
Yes.
And then you get tree rats and they're like, you
First
know,
of we all tree rats. Dude, no.
I think they are called tree rats.
Ah, they are. That's what freaked me out.
They're here.
That's that metal band around the palm trees. I was like, is that for the homeless children so they don't climb?
Climb up for a coconut?
Yeah, exactly.
They want a date?
They have nests of rats in trees?
Mm-hmm.
No, thank you.
Now, apparently, that's the ones we got here.
No, thank you.
Yeah. So you didn't go into biology. You didn't go into painting. Biology is required. Your dad probably, he probably had something to say about biology. He had to do all that shit.
Well, I remember he goes, so, you know, he left. He's out there. And so I was like, you know, it was college time. And he's
so was he talking like, hey, man?
No, he's like, I assume that you're the profunderance of thoughts and feelings. I mean, that's how he talked to me. And I'd be like, what? He's like, you know very well what my musings mean. I'm like, musings? What the fuck?
So
he sent me like this application for University of California, Berkeley's chemistry department. And I'm like, are you insane?
Yeah.
Do you know I've been doing acid for the last 4 years? I can't do this. You know, so I just went on to Michigan.
You were an acid guy?
Oh, yeah. Mescaline, THC. More than I care to.
In high school?
Yeah, started about 15, 14. Window pane.
Really? That. So that was the good shit. So it, that was.
I've never been that high ever in my life.
What was that like? So what year was that? 70?
I'm going to say 71. Something like that.
So it had trickled into the mainstream, like acid was around.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, we got it. You know, same thing as like give Billy, you know, your $5. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and that was, you went out there, huh?
I did, man. And it was, I'll put it like this. It was like, it took me 12 hours to realize I was in a room with no ceiling that was on fire.
Yeah.
So that's how high I was.
Was it really on fire?
No, it was my mom's living room. I mean, what are you nuts? And my mom followed me around.
You're not supposed to trip with your mom.
Exactly. Well, that was never the plan. My friends dropped me off on the front lawn and my mom found me at like 3 a.m. playing with the dog. Like, see, it's no connection. Oh my God. You know, so she was worried. She was a single mom.
And, and her son's on acid playing with the dog.
Yeah, talking about Jimi Hendrix or whatever, you know.
Oh, but you got to, like, it's so nice to, like, I envy that you were cognizant and engaged in the world when that shit was happening. Like in 68, 72, I was nine. So I'd see pictures, I saw Mad Magazine, but like you were like a few years older. So you're like, I got the record, man.
Well, my brother actually saw Hendrix. I never saw him, but there's a very-
Oh, that's right, you got the older brother with the shit.
there's a story that needs to be told. I've never actually, I wrote it down because I actually did a research and stuff to go back and ask. But this time that my brother told me that, you know, Hendrix had come to Detroit and I must have just turned 13.
Yeah.
And he went, he wouldn't take me.
Yeah.
And he met Hendrix.
Come on.
Yeah. And Hendrix, they went to his dressing room and he brought him on stage. This was a myth in my family. And for years, I just thought my brother told me this to rub it in, you know, and
he never made it up.
Yeah, I always thought. I never really believed him. And just a couple of years ago, he told me how he got this email from his friend, Michael, who had gone with him that night. And he read me the email and I'm in the car and my eyes well up because it was like, I remember all the cool stuff we did. It's so great to connect with you. Remember that night with Hendrix and how he talked to us? And it was all you, man. Like, And I'm sitting there going, oh, my God. My brother was a hobbit. Yeah. You know, like, really? Like, he met the Dwarf King.
Yeah.
And so I just was like, oh, my God. I never believed it. I still get goosebumps. And so it was just a bonding thing. Like, oh, my gosh, he wasn't lying.
Oh, my. Where's your brother at?
He's living in Daly City.
Yeah?
Living in Daly City. He moved with my dad.
Oh, by your dad, yeah.
And he never came back. I mean, he just stayed in the Bay Area. And
what's he do?
He is retired. Uh-huh. He took care of my mom until the very end. She lived 95 and a half.
Wow.
And he did the dirty work.
Oh, he did.
Oh, my God. Daly.
Yeah,
man.
Yeah.
You know, I was like, you know, I can take her, man. Yeah. But I'm busy. I'm doing a lot of things, man. Ding-a-lings. I got Thursday to Sunday, so, you know. So I send her money and stuff. But
yeah.
He is going to heaven. I mean, that, trust me.
Yeah.
So he's chilling. I mean, he's
that's
chilling.
Nice. And your sister is still around?
She's living still in Detroit.
And oh yeah.
I'm the youngest. So here we go.
And you're all close.
I'm closer to my brother.
Yeah.
But if you have brothers and sisters, it goes weird. There was a point when
in and out.
Exactly. I was closer to my sister when she moved near me when I was in New York, like in 75.
I think that has something to do with the fact that like me and my brother are close, but like when it gets too close and they you know them inside and out, they know you inside and out. Yeah. And if they're fucking up and they don't want to cop to it, then it gets a little trippy, right? You're what's going on with you? I'm all right.
Yeah, it's like, dude, get the
Yeah.
One time my brother goes, you're like, yeah, my nephew's, he's 21 or whatever. He's like, I mean, you know, he's acting crazy. And I'm like, what? Give me an example, man. You know, talk to me. No, I mean, he's like I'm crazy. You know, he's saying like I'm crazy, but it's not me. I know it's him. I'm like, well, what does the surgery say? Well, I was saying, you know, he's 19, 20, whatever. We can sit, watch porn together. I was like, time out. See, that's inappropriate. Hey. Why? We're both young adults. And I'm like, I never want to watch porn with my dad. Okay. And he's like, okay. Like, I guess you're crazy. And I'm like, yeah, dude. So, you know, there's those things where sometimes you have to, you know, drop the hammer.
So what led you to the acting, man?
How did that happen? Well, you know, I dropped out of school. I went to Michigan. And
Michigan State?
No, University. Come on, man. University of Michigan.
That's a good one, right?
That's the good one.
Yeah.
Not a good one.
Yeah.
In Michigan, that's the school.
So, yeah.
Went there, dropped out my freshman year. I always played really shitty guitar.
Oh, yeah?
Always, yeah. Tons of songs, really bad.
You still play?
I do.
Yeah.
I do, badly. I mean, now I have all the guitars of my dreams, like every other.
I try not to get. I try to get them for free, and I don't go crazy. I did spend some money on some amps.
Yeah, I've done all that.
Yeah. Got a little money. You're like, I'm buying them all. Right.
I'd like the Marshall.
Yeah, of course.
I never.
Did you buy a Hendrix Strat?
No, because I always thought that was sacrilegious. Oh, yeah. I can't play like Hendrix, man. Right. I mean.
So what's your guitar?
Right now I'm into Les Pauls. And
yeah,
I was
me too.
Very late to
me
the
too.
Game.
To Gibsons? Late. I was always a Fender guy.
Mm-hmm.
And now I got a couple Gibsons and I'm like, holy shit, these are magic. Yeah.
They really are. I mean, that guitar can do everything.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Which Les Paul you got?
I have what happened was, you know, one of my first guitars was like a 73 Les Paul Deluxe.
Yeah, the gold top?
No, it was a cherry red.
Uh-huh.
You could buy it like $300.
Yeah.
You know, and I customized it and all this. Sure. It was stolen, like every guitar ever.
Yeah. So I lend mine and then they disappear. Like, I know who had them and where they went.
No.
But then you can't get them back.
No. It usually went like, David, did Tommy's mom tell you to call me? Yeah, Mom, what's going on? All right, I just don't want you to be upset. Mom, what's going on? Son, sit down. And I was like, Mom, what happened? Well, I came home from school and I asked you to put the dishes in the sink. I was like, Mom, what? She goes, there's been a break-in. Right. I was like, oh my God, Mom, go in my closet and look. Well, I have to put the groceries down. Uh-huh. You know, she's there and I'll call you back. There's no guitar.
Yeah.
So the guitar was stolen.
Uh-huh.
She gave me money.
Yeah.
I bought another one. That's when I bought the Les Paul.
Remember? Yeah.
Yeah. So I wanted to replace that guitar.
Right. Nostalgia.
And I started looking around and playing. And I'd also had a big theft, you know, here in California. I had a bunch of very valuable vintage guitars that were stolen.
Yeah.
And I just was done. I'm done with old, crusty, vintage.
Yeah.
I just want something that sounds good
and
I can replace.
Sure. Yeah, so. I never got into that. Like, I got some amps that are kind of classic, but I won't do the, I can't collect it. I got a lot of guitars, but I try to talk them out of the guys. Like, hey, I'll talk about them on the thing. I'll play them on the show.
Yeah.
I'll play them on the show. You give me, and I'll do the thing. And it takes a couple of years, and eventually they relent. And they give me
motorcycles,
one.
I did that with. But
the
guitars, I just, you know, most of my life, trading albums, selling albums, like in the 70s.
I'm still doing that.
Well, that was my currency. I mean, when I was in college, I lived above a used record shop. So whenever I was out of money, I would just go and trade albums.
Yeah.
That was instant cash. The same with guitars. I always bought really great vintage guitars. When I was broke, I would sell them or, you know, do whatever. I never hocked them. I just sold them and it was like, okay, well.
You back into records?
I have a core, not currently, but I got into comedy albums, like the old black comedy albums.
Sure.
The best, you know, Blue Fly and Red Fox.
The party records?
Yeah.
Yeah, those are great. Yeah.
Yeah, so that was probably my last run.
Yeah. Wanted yeah, I'm just back into it. I'm in the rabbit hole with the records.
Hey, man.
Yeah.
Get it.
So, all right, so you drop out of Michigan.
Yeah, so I went to New York. I was reading Cream Magazine.
Sure.
And Soho Weekly, Village Voice. And right then was the punk scene. I was like the Ramones and Patti Smith and all this.
72, 73?
Yeah, 74.
Uh-huh.
And I just felt like if I don't go at this moment, then I'm going to miss it. And also, I looked upon it, of course I didn't tell my mom this, but this is my year abroad.
Yeah, sure.
So I just took my money and I took the tuition money and moved to New York City, you know, the Lower East Side, 75.
Yeah.
I lived there for a year.
Oh, yeah.
And at that time is when I started hanging out with actors in New York and I figured this is what I can do with my life. Because I really said, look, you suck at guitar. What's the best? You know, you get an album, a bald spot. And you're fucked. You're fucked in like 9 years. You're pot belly. You know, do acting. You can get old doing it.
Really? You thought that you were...
Yes.
You're thinking the long term.
Yeah, because I was already jaded. I mean, I was already... You know, by the 70s, all those groups, I'd seen everybody and Led Zeppelin, all that stuff. And,
yeah, but on some level, it's sort of like what you said about your old man and about like, you know, getting into a business.
Yes, yes,
that you could call your own.
But
you at least acknowledged your talent to some degree.
I didn't know. I didn't know if I had talent yet.
So you're hanging out with actors, and how do you proceed?
Here's what happened. I'm going to tell you this. So I worked at the Haagen-Dazs Ice Cream Store. It was on 86th Street.
Like the original one or something?
No, but back at that time.
In the 70s?
Haagen-Dazs. Yes.
Yeah.
Haagen-Dazs. There were only two stores in the world.
Yeah.
You could, this guy who owned these two stores that you could walk in and get a cone. Back then, Haagen-Dazs ice cream was like exotic.
Yeah, sure.
You know, and people would line up and you would scoop until you had carpal tunnel. So that's what I was doing.
Yeah.
Guy comes in and I was just tired. I was tired. It was the end of the night and he asked me something. I got up on the counter and I did this whole routine and I jumped down. The guy was like, I'm going to tell you something. You are an actor and you are wasting your life. Now, you don't know who I am.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not some pervert.
Yeah.
I'm going to give you this card. This is an agent. You need to go and call this person. And it's your life, but this is what I feel you're destined to do. This really happened.
Yeah.
So I said, okay. And that's what started it. That's what started it.
You called the guy?
Yes. I went to this agent and they were legitimate. And they were saying, like, look, you really need some training. I mean, you got to get into scene study. And so then I applied to the Neighborhood Playhouse.
Uh-huh.
Sanford Meisner,
right.
Sat there and interviewed me. But, you know, at the time I was like, yeah, some old white guy. Yeah, talk weird, whatever.
Yeah.
And he interviewed me. Like, we talked for, like, over an hour. And he said, you know what? I like you a lot. I'm going to let you in. But then I had to raise, like, the money to go there. My mother would never pay for it. So that led me to go back to Michigan, start acting there, and then move back to New York. I mean, it just seemed like the logical thing.
You went back to school?
Yes. And I said, because then I can, you know, I knew that I would have the support of my family.
Right.
My friends.
As long as you were in college and they could think, exactly, like, he won't stick with this.
Yes, that was it. Because I never majored in acting.
Right.
I majored in journalism. She's like, well, okay, I'm a Negro reporter. That's acceptable. By the way, David, something's happened. What, Mom? We had another break-in. What? There were like five break-ins when I was in there, like every week.
Another guitar.
Oh, they took everything. Yeah.
You finished Michigan.
Yeah, I finished Michigan, and at that point, I was majoring in journalism.
But you're acting like in the stage troupe thing?
Everything.
In college or outside of college? Oh, okay.
We formed our own theater company. I was full on. It was like, this is what I'm going to do.
But not training, really.
Doing it. I mean, I was studying acting. That's where really I took classes. I just couldn't major
right.
in it.
The school.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And then I applied to Yale, got in.
Holy
shit. My roommate, who's Reg E. Cathy, people know because he's pretty well known, I guess.
Yeah.
I mean, we both got in.
Yeah.
And then I went from Yale. It was like...
That was 2 years at Yale or four?
Three.
3 years at Yale. So that was... And that's the preeminent acting program at that time.
Meryl Streep went there.
Like Juilliard and Yale was it.
Yeah, I applied to Juilliard and they're like, no, thank you, sir.
But Yale was big, right?
So it was huge, man.
So you had to do the whole thing. You had to do movement. You had to do dance. You had to do swordsmanship. Yeah, fencing, ballroom, Alexander technique.
We didn't do ballroom, but we did do, some phonetics. We had phonetics and we had speech. It was like, the MGM,
But who was in your class? Were there people?
People that went there with me around that, Rock Dutton I met there.
Yeah.
Kate Burton, Jane Kazmarek, John Turturro, some people like that.
You know him?
Yes. We were all in school there.
Yeah. That must have been amazing.
It was amazing. It was amazing.
Because there's, like, if you go to Yale, that's all you're doing because New Haven's a shithole.
Exactly right. It was like going to school in Detroit, really.
Yeah.
But on the serious side, because it was only all about art. That's all we did
24/7.
And you didn't have the pressure of your career.
Right.
Didn't have the pressure of, well, you were just in this, Strindberg one act. How is that going to affect your TVQ? No, we were just doing the work.
Well, in those years that, a career was not the focus. Like,
no.
they didn't, there wasn't as many options. It was a long shot. Mm-hmm. And you got into it to do theater.
So I was bought in. I was just cult fan.
So you doing member. You were doing all you were doing Strindberg. You were doing Shakespeare.
All of it. All of it. And I in particular, for some reason, I did like 33 productions in 3 years. I mean, a million and all different kind of stuff. It really changed my life. And we would do, I started doing comedy. Like we would do, I think we did this evening of comedy,
At Yale?
Yes, in the cabaret. And I would sing, I still wrote songs and I would go to New York and do workshops but at that point, those people I knew, like one of the guys, I guess, that I met while there, like Steve Forbert, who became kind of
the
cool
singer?
For a minute. Yeah.
Yeah, I remember
we
him.
We would all do open mics, that kind of stuff. But anyway, that's
and you were doing singing or doing stand-up?
No, I never did stand-up when I was in New York. I was a musician. Dare you?
A musician and actor.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then I tried comedy, which was,
What?
Nothing. I lived around the block from the...
Catch
a Rising Star.
In the 70s?
Well, that was actually... I moved after I graduated. I moved back to New York, and that was my apartment. And that's where I met Chris Rock. I mean, a bunch of people.
Late 70s.
Yes, 80 actually. 80. 81. Yeah, 81.
So you graduate Yale, having done everything from Shakespeare to David Rabe to Beckett.
Everything.
To, Yeah, and then your first couple, you get movies pretty quick, right?
No, I mean, my first job was to star in a musical on Broadway about Jackie Robinson, the first African-American ball player. Now, here's how it went down. Like, you know, my mom.
What was it called?
It was called The First.
Yeah.
And on my graduation, my dad came, and this was the one time where he was speechless.
Oh, yeah? That's good.
Like, he's walking around. And,
after the show?
No, this is the graduation day.
Oh, okay.
And he's like, yeah, he's like, how did you do this? Like, he was so disconnected. He was like, you know, so you want to join the circus? When did this start? And I was like, well, it's a passion. And he was totally blown away, you know? And I just was like, God, please, please give me one job. I will become a male hustler. Please just let them feel like, I have something. Well, and but, like magic.
But he was impressed, though.
Fuck yeah, he was speechless. Yeah. And I went, oh my God, it was just a great feeling.
When you got the job and you could tell him? And...
Well, no, first of all, that day.
Yeah.
And I literally made that prayer. I said, please give me one job. I'll be unemployed for 10 years just to shut them up. And I got this role.
Yeah.
It was to the star in this musical. Plus, it was like acting. You know, it was about black people, white people. You know, I sang songs like, and Mama, I can play that game. Son, it's not your time. You know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
I can climb that tree. You know, that kind of stuff. Yeah. And so my dad came. Everybody came. And I was like, thank you.
Yeah.
And my mom freaked the fuck out.
Yeah.
She just went nuts. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, that's my son. And, you know, it was cool. I mean, it's cool if you've had that moment. I know not everybody does, but it was
sometimes
cool.
It takes a long time, if at all, for them to realize, like, I guess he's doing something.
I always hated you.
Yeah.
But I mean, I got that.
Yeah.
So it really was. But I'll tell you one time, like, so when we closed, you know, we only ran for 3 weeks. We closed and my
world wasn't ready.
I don't know. It just, it just flopped.
Yeah.
It just flopped. Real good hearted. I mean, you know, at that time, people would come from Brooklyn.
Sure.
It was all about the Dodgers.
They would sit
there
remember.
And they would cry. I mean, the scrim, our curtain, was the old fence from Ebbets Field. They recreated it.
What was the audience? Was it mixed or was it?
It was papered. Is right. It was, because I remember one of the last performances, again, me in the class. I go, I think we're gonna make it. You know, and they're like, look, the it's almost a full house. And like the stage manager goes, kid, that's your cue. And I go, yeah, but come on. He goes, the audience is papered. I said, what does papered mean? There's Jackie now. And I had to run on stage. And I'm like, oh God, now we know. But it was amazing. It was like I was on cloud nine.
It must have been so exciting to be on a big stage, and who cares if it's papered? I mean,
no,
to be on Broadway.
That was the end. Literally, for that period, everything I could have dreamt in my life
came
true.
Yeah.
And the last day when we were closing, I had never gone through this, and I remember I got in a cab, and I said, take me around the park. And the guy rode me around the park, and I just like bawled like a kid, you know. I was like, it's, and I come into the theater and everyone's crying. Everyone, like, these are old, hardened crew members weeping, you know, and it just,
because they were
killed me.
Attached to the show. They thought it was a great
show. They believe, I mean, it was a sweet show. It was a very New York show.
Yeah.
And it was because, what the play was about, if there's a great documentary about the Dodgers, because this was a time in New York where they got it right. You know, and Ebbets Field, this cross section of Brooklyn, these are baseball players who lived in the community because they didn't make that much money.
Yeah.
When they were not training, they worked at like the appliance shop,
right,
or at a car dealership.
Yeah.
So they were in the community, and it was a very special time.
Yeah.
So it was great.
I think you should revive it.
Only if I can play him now.
Yeah.
There's young Jackie.
You come like, I'm a little older.
Well, I'm kind of stiff, boys. You know, I've been married 3 times. I'm like, what? He's 22.
If Jackie had lived.
But, you know.
How long did he live?
Sadly, once he retired, it's like his body fell apart. I mean, he developed diabetes, which he died in his 50s. Really. Oh. But the connection was that most African Americans who excelled.
Yeah.
Like during that period, kind of like my dad, you had to be super exceptional. I mean, Jackie Robinson got a lettered in like three different sports.
Right.
He could have become an Olympic athlete,
right,
a baseball player, a football player, you know, basketball player, anything.
Well, that's interesting. You couldn't coast. You couldn't, you know, take anything for granted because you had to, you know, not only make the cut, you had to be above it.
Man, yeah.
So you no one could like, argue it.
Uh-uh. You had to be like, I'm going to take these white people and let them know. You right. couldn't be like, uh-uh.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, yeah, it was wild. It was wild.
People. And then when did the movie start?
Well, after the musical, you know, I was nominated for a Tony that year, which was, you know, it brought me into the community.
The world,
you know,
the
acting,
yeah.
Professional yeah. acting. I did a show called Soldiers Play at the Negro Ensemble. And we all, I think my first film was Streamers with Robert Altman.
That's heavy, man.
Yeah, man. It was, that was, again, it was like.
It's a heavy play.
Are you kidding me?
God damn.
I'll tell you, like David Rabe, right? I met him at this place where we all used to hang out. And I go, hey, man, David, it's me, David Alan Grier. I'm a young Negro actor. Yeah. And I'm going to be in your play. But we're doing a movie. He goes, I know. I'm like, okay. It's right. kind of weird attitude. I'm so excited. He said, you better not fuck it up. And I was like, okay, I'm going to go sit over here now. He scared the shit out of me. But I saw him afterwards and he liked it. So yeah. That was great.
There's some heavy monologues in that play.
Hey, man. And Robert Altman, man. Yeah. Come on. It was, again, it was just.
That was that period where Altman was shooting those plays.
Like yes.
When You Coming Back to the Five and Dime, Streamers, and he did, there was another
Super
one.
Super 16 is what it was called. And of course, people laughed at him, you know, because I remember I would go into like real big movies and they'd be like, I see you did Streamers.
Really?
Oh, yeah. I remember this one well-known director and he goes, yeah, you shoot on that Super 16. All right, go ahead and read.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, what was Altman like at that point?
He was so great. I mean, he taught me about movie making.
Yeah.
Because first of all, the dailies.
Yeah.
That's all the footage you've shot that day.
Yeah.
The director and everybody, they have to watch everything to choose the takes.
Yeah.
And it was a completely open process. You know, that's where Altman was. He said, look, I'm not going to hide anything from you. I encourage you actors to come and see this work because he wanted us to buy into the process.
Yeah.
I want you to care about what we're doing. Right, you're going to learn.
Right. So the next day you're like, yes. Hey, we know what's up.
Exactly. And maybe I should tone it down.
Yeah. Right. You know? Oh, right.
All that. And so we went every night. There's like a little bar in the back and we would all watch. And I learned so much on that movie.
Wow.
And so he didn't over direct.
Yeah.
I mean, he told me several times, he's like, you know, my biggest job is casting. So one of the things when we auditioned is we would read through the whole play, which is at his apartment. He had this place on Central Park. And he would switch people out. But I mean, you stay there. You read the whole first act or the whole entire play.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, I never have since had a audition process.
Right.
Like that, you know?
Well, I talked to a lot of directors and it turns out like a lot of them, you know, it's really like I cast you. Do what I hired you to do.
Yes. I already believe in you.
Yeah, exactly. You know?
But so it was great. It was a real great learning process. Also, it demystified it because before that film, I didn't know how you got a film. I was like, well, maybe I'm not doing it right.
Yeah.
You know, maybe I need to, you know, film acting is different because this is what we were always told. You know?
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of stops and starts. You can't get a groove going, really.
Action cut. That's lunch. Yeah. You know, but so I didn't know the process and it was really great.
And you went from there to Soldier Story?
Yeah.
That was another, Jewison, was it Norman Jewison?
Jewison.
And that was, I remember that movie. That movie is a devastating movie.
It is. I mean, I'd been in the play and.
It was called The Soldier's Play at that time?
Yes. Yeah. And you know, Sam Jackson was in there.
Oh, really?
But his role was cut out of the movie.
Uh-huh. You know?
And for like a few years, because I was rolling, you know, Denzel Washington, who was a friend, we were all like, it was like, poor Sam, you think he'll ever get it together? I don't know. He's really tall and weird. Anyway, yeah. And like
he did all right.
Yeah, he's fine. I mean, he just blew the fuck up. And
that's right. Denzel was in that too.
Yep.
Guy, you know, the Washington. Two I get confused. What's the other one? The Civil War one.
Well, all the black people.
Yeah.
Oh, you mean Glory?
Yeah.
Well, he was great in Glory.
Ooh, man.
Oh, this is another... So I read for Glory, but at the time, the guys who directed it, the guy who directed it also had 30-something on the air, which I loved. And I was like, listen, I don't really want to play a slave, but I'd love to do 30-something. That's really... Oh, yeah. So I was like, yeah, David, you're playing J-Bo. All right, go. I was like, you can't. I got to... You're like, thank you for coming in. And I get in the car like, I think I really got his ear on the 30-something. Yeah, again, I was wrong.
And you got to play J-Bo on 30-something.
No, I didn't. Yes, of course. I got nothing is what I got. I got the call where your agents go, what happened today? But I think it was pretty good.
But the fascinating thing about like your career is that all whatever you did as an actor, like leading up to it, you have a very sort of varied actor's career. I mean, you've done fucking everything.
But I mean, I always wanted to do it like that.
Yeah, but it's amazing because not everybody gets to do it like that. You've never stopped working, and you know that you took opportunities where you could. And the opportunity that makes you is like you're already 3 or 4 or 5 movies into whatever when In Living Color happens, right?
Wow. But Dig, that year that you know we had done, I'm Gonna Get You, Sucker.
Yeah.
Now, first of all, I got to roll
with
back.
The weigh-ins.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And that's where, when I did Soldier's Story, I shared a honey wagon or, you know, like a little dressing room with Robert Townsend.
Yeah.
Robert Townsend would do these routines. And I'm like, this is the funniest dude I have ever seen in my life. And he would go, I'd be like, is this your act? And
I remember watching him on stage at the Comedy Store.
Yeah. The improv. And he said, but Robert would go, he'd go, no, that's my act. That's my boy's act. Damon. He was doing Mo Money. He would do a sprinkle of Keenan stuff, and I'm like, who are these people?
Yeah.
And I need to meet them. So he introduced me to the Wayans, and I would hang out in comedy clubs with them. Once I moved out, that's what I did every night.
So interesting, those two guys as comedians, because like when I was a doorman at the Comedy Store in like 80, whatever the fuck it was, 87, like Damon had not broke huge, so he was still doing stand-up, and it was I would sit there in the main room doing the door, and like I said, are you going to do that thing tonight? He's like, no, tonight's going to be jazz set.
Hey, and man. Hey, him and Jim Carrey would talk about, do you remember that time I got in the piano and I stayed there for an hour and a half? And I was like, that must have been uncomfortable. What? I don't get it. Where was the punchline?
Right, it didn't
Could
matter.
Could people hear you? Yeah. You know, they were like, no, David.
Keenan was just straight up stand-up.
Yes.
Totally like, and Damon was like out there.
Well,
and
Keenan.
Keenan was like, hear the jokes.
He was in, when we were doing Soldier Story, Keenan was in the centerfold of Right On magazine, you know, with a shirt, no shirt on.
Right,
like,
right.
Hey, ladies, what's up? Yeah. You know, laying this dick on all of y'all. And I was like, fuck, man, that's huge.
Yeah.
I remember we saw him on The Tonight Show in our motel in Arkansas, you know? And I remember the bit. He would do this bit like how the last person that got on the train, subway train, as the doors closed, it was like watching a baby being born, and he would physically do it. It was hilarious, and I'm like, this guy's a genius too. There's something in their family. So long story short, I would hang out with those guys, and it was just by osmosis. They said, look, you have to get on stage if you're going to be here, and it was more like a dare. So you know, I just started for fun doing spots. And
at the improv?
No, I chose the Laugh Factory because it was a black hole. Nobody.
I remember that. It was like a hallway.
Yes. It was, nobody would go in
next
there.
To that old Chinese restaurant that closed. It was like, I remember that because I was at the doorman at the Comedy Store in the mid 80s. And you'd go to the Laugh Factory, and it's just like you'd walk in the door and you were in the room.
Yes.
And in order to go to the bathroom, you had to walk down the right side to that door, and the guy would be on stage right there. And any time you went there, Paul Mooney was on stage.
Well, exactly
and Fraser Smith. It was Fraser Smith and Paul Mooney.
You're exactly right. And Paul Mooney, this is when Paul Mooney was firing.
Sure.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
I just felt like I could work out at the Laugh Factory.
Yeah.
I always hated the Comedy Store. I was always intimidated, hated the improv.
Yeah. Too much pressure.
It was too much. Yeah. It was too much. And so that's where I started.
Yeah.
And from there, I remember standing in line. I'd done the pilot to In Living Color. So you could only do it once a month. So the next month, In Living Color had come on, and I'd done like...
Do what once a month?
Like the open mic, whatever their policy was at that time.
You had to follow the policy?
Yeah, because I wasn't anybody. Right. I was just
the policy of the Laugh Factory, like Jamie Masada, who was working the register.
Yes, and the door. Yeah, nobody, no.
When you walked in, you just this mean Israeli dude.
Oh, yeah.
He'd be like, you just here last week. No, brother.
And I'm like, what are you kidding me?
There's like 40 seats in the place.
Oh, yeah. But I remember the Wayans, all those guys, when I would do spots, they would, I have it on tape.
Yeah.
Do it again. Your premise, you too long with the premise, man. Come on. They would like, tell me this.
While you were on stage?
While I'm trying to do these bits. And my bits were one act plays.
Yeah,
okay, because that's where I came.
Yeah.
As the gentleman entered the bar, he's like, shut up. So, any rate, the deal was I come back a month later, In Living Color was on, my three national commercials, and these homeless comedians were like, what the fuck happened? He did one spot, and this guy blew up. And I could never bring myself to say, look, dude, I had a career, okay?
Yeah.
So that's what they thought.
That's interesting because, like, comedians, it's sort of like their trajectory is what it is. You know, you hammer it out, then you get the break on The Tonight Show, then maybe you get a deal to do a show. Here you're at Yale, you're doing Jackie Robinson, you did movies, you did TV shows, you got commercials, you went the whole other way, and then you show up in the Comedy Land, and they're like, who the fuck is this guy to get this shit?
Yeah.
The guy's an open micer.
Yeah.
Right.
That's exactly what happened. I remember I did a spot at the Comedy Store. And they were like, this dude's funny.
Yeah.
They grabbed Mitzi.
Yeah.
They said, they brought me to the main room.
What did she say?
Well, she was back there. And like one of my big jokes was like, Detroit police, bang, freeze. And she goes, that's Mike Binder's joke. He's from Detroit. Stole it. And I was like, Mike, who? He's like, you're a thief. But she said, keep working and come back. You know,
you're a thief, but I like you.
No, she said, you know, that's his joke. But she was encouraging, but that room was too much.
The original room? The little one?
Yes. Yes.
It's heavy, dude.
It is.
It takes a while to get comfortable there. And if you never get comfortable there, you'll never be comfortable there. Like,
I mean,
let you go in there tonight and feel that shit.
I probably could. I mean, I performed there several times, you know. Back in that period, and they said come by anytime. That just wasn't my room as a comic, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
that just wasn't the place where I could. Laugh Factory was that place,
right? It's a little looser there. You feel like it's you got less to lose for some reason.
I could just stretch out, And you know, back in the day, we would do like I remember I'd get in a car, rent a wreck,
I'd
do as many spots as I could, four or five spots.
In preparing for Living Color ish?
No,
or just
this
to do
was
it?
Just because once I got into
all right,
it.
You got to prove yourself.
Right. It was just obsessive, and I would record every set, and they all sound the same.
Yeah.
One people I would kill, one audience, the next, same energy, same. Yeah. It was just crickets.
Yeah.
And finally, I just stopped recording myself because it taught me nothing.
I record and then I don't listen. That's my game.
Well, I would be like,
guys, have you ever eaten popcorn and you know, on cheese doodles, the dust gets on your fingers?
Yeah.
I'm like, you suck!
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And like the next, they're like screaming, hollering, and I'm like, why? I don't know why.
Yeah. You can't figure out the magic.
No.
So then how did the show come to be? It was on the air before you started on
no,
it?
No. We'd done...
you were there at the beginning, right?
Yeah, we'd done I'm Gonna Get You Sucker. And, you know, when Eddie Murphy first popped...
Wait, is that... I'm Gonna Get You Sucker. Is that Roberts or the Wayans movie?
It was supposed to be both of them.
What was Roberts' first movie called? The one with the credit?
Hollywood Shuffle.
Oh, okay, that's it. Okay. Got it.
Hollywood Shuffle. Yeah. So I'd come out to do a pilot. I did this show for the Charles Brothers, NBC. It was called All Is Forgiven, like in 86 or something.
Right.
First television show. Anyway, in Living Color, everyone talked about someone should do a black SNL.
Yeah.
They should do a black Saturday Night Live.
Right.
Eddie Murphy talked about doing it, never came to fruition. So Keenan just took up the mantle. He is the first one to actually do it. Like, he got this opportunity and he said, we're going to do the sketch show.
Yeah.
And he called me up and he said, I want people to know how funny you are. You know, because he'd seen me from the very beginning and hanging out with those guys. Robert at that time was my best friend. We hung out with each other all night.
How's he doing now?
I don't talk to him. Mm. But the point is, I don't know. I haven't seen him in a long time.
I haven't seen him either.
I don't know where he is, but I know he and Keenan are still
tight.
But so that was what it was. He said, I think you should do this. And it was in a year where I must have auditioned for 30 pilots.
Uh-huh.
And after years of trying to control the narrative, meaning, you know, Stephen Boschko is doing a singing
replacement.
I can guarantee you, David, much like the Deaf Theater's production of Othello, this is going to kill.
Yeah.
And I'm like, wow. You know, I just did In Living Color for fun because my friends were in it.
Yeah.
They didn't pay us any money that first year. My agents did not want me to do it.
Yeah.
So I turned it down.
Yeah.
And Kim Wayans called me. I moved back to New York in my old apartment, and she called me and she talked me down. She said, you've got to come back out. You have to do this show. I'm telling you, it'll change your life. And I listened to her. That's why.
And it did.
It absolutely did.
There's a lot of episodes, dude. A lot of characters, a lot of, you know, and you're, everybody looked like they were having so much fucking fun, and there's some weird shit going on.
Well, I remember we had this long table.
Yeah.
So we'd come in the morning and we'd have breakfast. And we were comics. We were young. We didn't give a shit. Mm-hmm. And it was all about making each other laugh. So that was where I saw Fire Marshal Bill. That's where half the characters came there. And if you made each other laugh, like by the second or third day, you'd be like, Mark, you got to do that. You got to do the radio guy. You have to do it. Yeah. And you're like, okay. And that's how it happened. It was very organic. There was no, I think I know what our audience, 15 to 20. No,
you didn't have any executive heat on you?
No. And it's to Kenan's credit that we were protected. We never felt that pressure. He just said, do whatever you want. And then, you know, it was like, you know, you can't do the talking butthole or whatever. And they would just say, you know, within parameters, and we just go and do it. I mean, any encouragement, you said, don't wait for the writers.
Yeah.
You guys have to write for yourself. And I'm like, is he serious? You know, but it was.
And then you, I guess you probably made a, built alliances with certain cast members that you worked better with. Like you and Damon did a lot.
Yeah. But, you know, Damon, I remember he came to the dressing room early on. He said, look, man. Because he was a writer also, and he wrote with me, he wrote Calhoun Tubbs. He said, look, you need a character, David. And I was like, yeah, but, you know, doing announcing and, and bit parts in other people's sketches is working out. He's like, no, you have to have a signature character. Yeah. So I told him about this guitar guy.
Yeah.
Like I told you, I loved playing guitar. Yeah. And we wrote it right in the dressing room. He says, cool, put this on. I was Calhoun Tubbs.
Yeah.
And that's what started, you know, started it rolling. And because I never wanted to be... That's not my nature. I'd never wanted to be on an SNL thing because basically you're crabs in a barrel.
Yeah.
You know, I've hosted it twice. And if you don't get, there's so much pressure. If you don't get on as a writer, they're going to fucking fire me.
Yeah.
I need you. You know, when you come in as a guest host, there's a guy in the back office. He's like, please do this avocado sketch, man. I got kids. Yeah, man, it is a death sentence. And you're like, yo, man, that shit's not funny. I'm sorry, I can't. And he's like, oh, yeah. So I didn't want to be in that situation. But in Living Color wasn't that.
Right.
There was competition.
Sure, but it was healthy.
Exactly.
He made each other better.
Theoretically, yes.
Well, yeah. Well, I mean, if you didn't have the heat and the pressure from the outside.
Oh, it was brutal, too. It was brutal. I mean, because we would laugh.
Yeah.
Nothing made us happier than when someone sketch bombed.
Of course. That's the comics laugh.
Oh, of course.
The singular laugh at the back of the room. It's you like, ah.
Or, well, the way is no one has a more obnoxious laugh than them if you've ever been. I'm like, no one laughs like that.
It was just an acknowledgement. It was punctuating your failure.
Yes.
It was doing.
Oh, yeah, I know
that one, yeah.
So Jim did, what was it called? The Diplomat or something? And he played, you know, this overwrought French diplomat with this big mustache.
Yeah.
And I, you know, me and Tommy, we're in the sketch. We get killed and we're behind the furniture and we can feel driplets of sweat hitting us. I mean, you look up, Jim's just like fucking sweating. The audience is like, what the fuck is this? And we were crying. We were crying. I mean, our bodies are like, I am the diplomat. You know, nothing but crickets. We fucking loved it.
It's the best. You don't see enough of that anymore. No. The camaraderie of enjoying the failure. Yes.
When you die.
Peer. Yeah. It's become, I don't know what happened to that, but back in the day in comedy clubs, you'd see people losing their shit.
Yeah.
You know, on stage.
Well, I'll tell you what happened is the dude from Seinfeld, man. I mean, you record that.
Yeah.
You know,
I guess that, well, that's true. That's true. But like, there's still like, it's weird. Like, yeah, if you're at a certain celebrity status where people know that this is going to be something, like, you know, I'm still under the radar and, you know, there's plenty of us who are still under the radar where there's not like, oh, I'm going to get him. He shouldn't be saying that.
Right.
You know, but you're right. There is a constant predatory surveillance, a predatory tabloid surveillance.
Yeah. Like when Tracy Morgan. Ugh. Got, you know, all the controversy about his jokes and the homophobic stuff. I was like, have you heard the rest of his act? I mean, they're like, and then finally, I think someone reviewed it on the Times, you know, when he came back and they're like, yes, this was offensive. So was everything.
Exactly.
Like, yeah.
That's what he does.
Yeah. But also comedy clubs, it used to be. Like, yeah. I remember when Chris Rock was trying new jokes at the Comedy Cellar, and he got reviewed in the Times.
It's like, fuck that.
Come on, man.
It's right. That used to be our place. That's back when I first got back to LA, no one was going to the Comedy Store. It was this dark hole. Yeah. And part of me was sort of like, good. Now right. I can just go get some shit done, take some chances. But now
I loved your bit about fucking and eating the baby. That was brilliant. Who shut you down?
Yeah. Why aren't you doing that anymore?
This is a comic moment.
Yeah, yeah.
I was at the Montreal, and I run into Kevin Hart. You know, it's 2010. This is before Kevin Hart became big.
Became the king of the universe?
Exactly. Yeah, he said, man, what's going on, Dave? I was like, man, I'm going through a divorce. He said, man, sit down. Everybody's going through a divorce. He said, how you doing? I said, I'm good now. I don't want my ex-wife to die, but I do want her to get cancer of the pussy. And he fell out. He was like, you have got to talk about that on stage. I'm like, what are you, nuts? I have a daughter. She's going to fucking sue me. What do you... No, I can't talk about that on stage. You know?
And he didn't do it?
No, I can't. I can't look my daughter in the... Why did you talk about mommy's vagina? Daddy was angry.
It was a joke. It was a joke. You got to learn sometimes jokes.
They just look at you like, what?
How old is she?
She's 9.
Oh, okay.
And still, though, I remember I showed her something that was really funny to me. She just looked at it like, what are you, why? Nuts?
They take it literally. Yeah, yeah.
She just doesn't get it.
Right.
She's not supposed to.
She will.
Hopefully. Yeah. Hopefully. But, you know, like I performed a few months ago in San Francisco, and the local comics, always some of the best, intelligent, most insightful comics. You know, these guys, I didn't know them. But they were so paranoid that every joke was an explanation of why it's not racist. You know, I got on the bus and there are two black guys, but I mean, good looking and they can do anything. Seriously. No. Yeah. And it was like, dude, just tell the joke. They were like, you don't know what it's like. I'm like, I guess not.
Call me old school.
Yeah. It's different. It's just different.
But the thing that fascinated me and it was that, you know, you always work, you do everything that an actor does, but also a comic actor, you have a lot of range and it's beautiful. And you're working with Gerard now and he's like, he's great. And that character is like, it's a rare fucking thing. And congratulations, not only to have such a kind of nonstop career, but then to age into a role that you can own at your age. What a fucking gift.
You know, I met Gerard in Montreal.
Yeah.
And
he's shiny.
Yes.
He's very shiny. Shiny.
He doesn't sweat. He's just glossy.
Yeah, I don't know if he's human.
He's a different kind of Negro.
Yes, he is.
Different kind of Negro.
Yeah.
Anyway, my thing is, I want to be funny today.
Yeah.
I want to be funny right now. And I still love it.
Yeah.
I mean, I still love the performing.
Feels good, right?
Fuck yeah. I didn't know people would want to hear from me now. And most of them don't.
That's not true. They just don't know that they do.
There you go. No, but I mean, that's it. I mean, I want to be the older actor that I wanted to work with when I was younger. You know what I mean? Not the dude who comes in like, listen, kid, you're going to suck cock if you want to make it. That's what you got to do.
Really?
Yeah. No, I want to be the guy.
And you can start now.
Exactly. I want to be that guy. There were some older actors who still had life and believed in the art and the craft. That's what I want to be.
But I also think the fact that like you can't stop yourself from getting on a mic or getting on a stage or taking a gig. Like, you know, you did a lot of work with Corolla. You went through a lot of pain and trouble with divorces in a very candid format. And ultimately what happens is, as some guy who is a too much information guy, is people get to know you too well. And, you know, and that's not a bad thing because you help a lot of people when you do that. But I think that, you know, the idea that people don't want to hear from you is the only thing that they know you pretty fucking well.
I didn't count on that. I didn't count.
I know,
on
but
that.
Like, you know, you're going to get on radio and you're going to do, if you're going to do Loveline and Corolla, they're going to, we got a live one here. He's broken and he's wide open.
But you know what, man? I remember I was in Dean and DeLuca.
Yeah.
A couple of things. First of all,
down on
back when it was, it's still there. West Broadway. Prince,
yeah, West Broadway or whatever.
Wait, I got to go back. When In Living Color was canceled,
yeah,
I really thought at that time, okay, I have about 18 months where I can headline clubs and venues. Then that's going to go away, and then I just have to, you know, go on with my career because there was no internet, no YouTube,
right.
No none of that. I couldn't picture this, the technological ability to press a button and collect all the favorite sketches you had. So I didn't see the longevity of the show.
Was not part of your job description.
No,
to foresee technology.
That's what I mean. Yeah. I didn't think it would be like this.
But you had it. You knew how you from seeing other people do it. You knew you had a window if you played it right,
which I did. But I didn't think at this point people would still be talking about In Living Color. I just didn't see it. Jim Carrey saw it.
Yeah.
Because he said from the beginning, he said, what we're doing is history. And he was like, what are you, nuts?
Yeah, it's TV. What do you mean history? Yeah,
This is not history. He saw that. I mean, I didn't see that. So here we are.
But no, but the beautiful thing is you're doing this character. After everything you've put out in the world, you've got this great character on a great sitcom with a creative guys. And then you do, and now you got this gig. I don't know what this game show is, but I think at the end here, we should pay some lip service to it because ostensibly.
It is a money maker. Let me tell you something.
No, I know, but I was going to tell you the premise, though. Oh. I like the premise.
It is. It's basically, you just, it relies on your prejudices.
Right. I think it's an interesting idea because I'm in here every fucking day with guys like you and whoever, like, you know, celebrities, and I think I know something.
Right.
And I'm always fucking wrong. And it's sort of fascinating to me how we judge people.
Yeah.
Does the show do any service to that? I mean, is there something socially relevant about the show or
It's for fun. It's for fun. No, we don't sit there. There's no PBS moment.
Your dad's not there going, I understand.
I'll put it like this. My dad was still alive when I did Dancing with with the Stars. And so I got eliminated. My father he wrote me an email. He said, shall I mobilize the troops? Is it because you're just too good looking and you have a Yale education that these bastards are jealous of you? I was like, no, not really, Dad. Thanks. it was very sweet. In these moments, I was like, my dad loves me. Twisted, inappropriate way, but he loves me.
Well, no, it's nice when you can see through, when they get to that point where they get past their competitiveness and their own dumb pride.
Yeah.
When you have a certain type of father, you got to find those moments of weakness where you're like, oh, he likes me.
Well, you have to read between the lines. And by the way, that email was not a joke.
Right.
He wasn't being funny.
This is when you lost?
Yes. Oh, he wasn't being funny. Absolutely serious.
Yeah, he was coming to your defense. Like, fuck them. Yeah.
Clearly, this is another
another example.
Bobo the white man has denied my son. You know, and I was like, pipe down, Dad. But anyway.
Oh, well, good. Well, man, it was great talking to you, and it was a lot of fun.
I'm a big fan of the show.
Oh, thank you.
Judd Apatow. Listened to that interview like 3 or 4 times.
Yeah.
Judd used to hang around in Living Color.
I'm sure. Yeah. Yeah.
And he'd like try and give jokes to
Sure. He sat there going like, I'm going to be the biggest thing in Hollywood comedy.
Well, I finally did a Judd Apatow movie. I did The Big Sick.
Oh, yeah. I saw that. You were great. That was great.
Well, it's a very small role.
Yeah, but it's an important role. Well, the club owner is the important role. The coked up club owner or club manager.
Oh, he's not the owner. He's the club manager.
Right, right. Who does stand up.
Yeah, isn't that in every club? Mm-hmm. Like the dude who is there that no one thinks is funny.
Right. But they know they need him.
He controls everything. Sure.
That whole system has gotten a little exhausted, because you can sort of circumvent it now.
Yeah.
The one guy in the town that's deciding whether or not you get on stage. Yeah. But they still exist.
Well, anyway, Emily
and
Gordon.
You know what? They're the biggest fucking criminal. They're the fucking monsters.
Well, they've been hacked by Russia.
Everybody has.
But Emily Gordon, she was a writer.
Yeah, she's great.
On the Carmichael Show. She told me she was doing a movie. I was like, great, you're a little movie. I'll do it. She's like, okay. So that's how it came about. I didn't know.
Did you like the movie when you watched it?
Of course. It was awesome, man.
You know what's awesome about it is like you watch it and you're like, there's no way this was made up. And it's so rare to see something translated like that. Like a very unique love story the darkness of it is so real.
The only thing they didn't capture is that.
Yeah.
So Emily is one of the happiest people I've ever met.
Yeah.
Like so joyous that I stopped her. This is how the conversation started. Why are you so fucking happy? And she goes, because everybody should be, because it's an amazing day. And I'm like, no, really, cut the bullshit.
Yeah.
Why? And she told me the story. Well, I almost died. And I'm like, you're lying. And she goes, no. I wrote a book about it and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, what?
Mm-hmm.
And she goes, yeah. And we wrote a script about it. And I'm like, what?
Yeah.
And I was like, knee jerk. Yeah, I'll do it. She goes, really? I said, yeah, I'll do anything. So that's what happened.
It's great.
Yeah.
It's great.
Yeah, yeah. Congratulations to them.
You're a busy man and it's good.
I got to go to work.
You right do? Now. Where are you going?
I'm going back home.
Yeah.
To just chill.
Do you live nearby?
I do not. Now, I have questions.
Yeah.
I live in the Hollywood Hills, but what is this neighborhood?
Highland Park.
Highland.
You'll get back Park. Easy. Where you live now? So you can go to the 134 or something? Come
yeah,
around
but
the back?
Is it Glendale?
No. Oh, you're close. It's sort of between Pasadena and Glendale, Highland Park.
This is a hip little pocket
yeah.
here.
Yeah, it's a nice little shtetl of
and
hipsters.
How long have you been here?
I've been here since 2004.
Wow.
And it was, you know, it's a nice little neighborhood. I didn't know anything about the neighborhood. I was driving a guy around who was looking to rent a house, and I saw this house for sale, and I had a little deal money. I'd never bought a house before. I'm like, that one seems good. And when I first moved here, and I was driving to him back and forth from the Comedy Store, I'm like, where the fuck do I live? What did I do?
Yeah.
But now
no,
it's like,
nice,
fuck it.
Man.
Come yeah, on. I like it. It's great, man. I'm glad we talked.
Absolutely.
Funny guy. Definitely paid his dues, definitely deserves all the work he gets, and works a lot. David Alan Greer, it was very nice having him here. You can always go to WTFpod.com for all your WTF Pod needs. Seems a lot of people don't check there before they tell me to have a guest on. WTFpod.com/podcast will get you a search bar where you can search all 800 now, however many episodes. All right? You dig it? I believe I may be talking to Vice President Al Gore next week. That should be exciting and harrowing and scary, but informative. Hopefully infused with a bit of hope. Should we play some guitar? I'm set up. Everything's clean. Some like nice stuff, not too crazy. Probably something I've done before. Why not? Why not do it? Why not? Why not?
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.